So what I'm going to talk about this afternoon is the practical aspects from a lay perspective of letting go, letting it be, however we want to define it. How do we actually do that? What does it mean? So here I'm going to start with two quotes from the Dalai Lama. Attachment is the origin, the root of suffering. Hence, it is the cause of suffering. I think we've heard that before. We understand that, kind of. And the second one is by Miguel Ruiz. There is a huge amount of freedom that comes to you when you take nothing personally. I think that one really speaks to me. He also is a Mexican writer who wrote The Four Agreements, and I've not read that, but I understand it's a very good book. So we hear this, we hear it from the Buddha, we hear we need to let it be, let it go. Wasn't that the name of a song in Frozen? Letting go or something like that. I didn't see it, so I don't know, but I heard somebody say that was it. But it's really slipped into our nomenclature. We hear this all the time, let it go, let it go. Well, what does that actually mean? On a very kind of sophomoric level, I think any of you who have gotten into simplifying your lives, getting rid of stuff, know how good it feels. It kind of is a little indication of what takes place when we start simplifying, letting things go, not clinging to things. I know I'm at the stage of my life where I just love going in a room, emptying it out, and seeing it almost empty. There's just something very, I don't know, affirming about an almost empty room and a clean floor. Could be an age thing, I'm not sure. But intuitively, that's what we aspire to. And I think that says something about letting go, how good it is for us to be doing that. However, does that mean all of you are going to give up your cars, your houses, your kids, your husbands? Are you going to go live on a mountaintop? You're going to be a recluse? I don't think most of us have that as our goal and meaning of letting it be or letting it go. I think most of us want to keep our essential stuff. And maybe we even appreciate our essential stuff. And my take of what the Buddha said, lay people can have release, can experience freedom in this lifetime, even with our stuff. And I think there's ways of doing that. And I think it's also redefining to a degree what is attachment. What exactly is attachment? And what is non-attachment? So if it's not just getting rid of all your stuff, and it's not divorcing your husband or your partner, it's not kicking your kids out or having nothing to do with your grandchildren, what is it? What is to be non-attached? I think it is accepting the truth about yourself, which is probably the most difficult thing to do of all, to not be attached to a lot of illusions about who you are and who everybody else is. This is actually the first of the Noble Eightfold Path, is right view. And right view asks us to look at all the views we have of ourselves and everything else. And we might notice when we do that how attached we are to the way we think life should be. At a retreat that Rich and I, Dennis, led, I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, one of the assignments I gave people was I want you to take a notebook, and every time you start judging something, write it down. And one lady said afterwards, I couldn't do it. I was writing constantly. I was judging everything. I couldn't let anything go. That's what attachment is. If you want to try that assignment, it will drive you crazy. It means we fall in love with an image of ourselves and an image of others. And even in the case of, I'll give you an example, you have a partner, you fell in love with that person, they're just perfect, and then 10 years later it's, they're not the person I married. What happened? Actually, exactly what is supposed to happen happened. That person changed, as did you, as does everything, constantly, every day, every minute. I've got a very good friend who, I spoke to last year, and she had, she's a little bit younger than I am. She was retired, her husband just retired, and he apparently was struggling with the retirement and started seeing another woman who he used to work with. My friend, being a Buddhist practitioner and someone I admire tremendously, saw through all the views. I think a person who's not practicing would just be really mad, start yelling, and just see how their ego has been thwarted by this insult. Instead, this person actually thought about it and realized her husband didn't want to let go of his youth. He didn't want to let go of his job. Everything that he thought about himself was wrapped up in this, and she understood. That's huge, and she actually talked to him about this, exactly that. And fortunately, because he trusts her, he saw the truth of it, and they're very happy. That's impermanence. This is a changing relationship. This is constant, constant change. And if you can't change with it, you are going to suffer, clinging to a view about how you think things should be. So this doesn't mean you stop caring about your spouse or the planet or animals, anything. You do your best. In fact, you appreciate so much because things are passing so quickly that the moment takes on a much deeper significance and importance to you. You know, the best example of this is, as I said this morning, do we get mad because we bring home a beautiful bouquet of flowers and they're going to fade? Do we get mad at them? Not fair. I don't like it like this. Why is this happening to me? No, we wouldn't, because our egos are not involved with the flowers. We accept it. We enjoyed them when they were beautiful, and now they're dying. And that's the way it is. Do we get upset when the leaves change and they're going to fall off the trees and run around beating our breasts saying, not fair, not fair? No, we accept it because our egos are not involved. Our self-identity is not involved. We appreciate the moment. It's interesting, too, in the 10 fetters that lead up to stream entry that I was talking about this morning, the very first fetter is self-identity. Self-identity. We cling to this self-identity of how we think we are and how we think the world should view us and how we should view ourselves and everyone else. And actually, I think it's the 7th or 8th is in the fetters conceit.
Yes,
it's the 8th. So you can see how difficult this is. The first is self-identity. What I'm talking about now in conceit is this subtle, subtle thing that happens after somebody's gone through all these wonderful steps in our awakening, and there's still that conceit there. as the eighth of these 10 fetters. So not an easy thing to do. So our attachment all originates with our egos. How we view our egos. What are we going to do with them? Oh, I found this, I think, really good example of, this is kind of a mundane example, but I really like it. So you're at home and somebody's staying with you, maybe your partner or a friend or child, and you're going to go out someplace and they say they'll make you a sandwich. And you say, okay, my favorite sandwich is, you know, name your favorite sandwich. Mine happens to be cucumbers, vegan cream cheese, and a red onion. I love that on whole wheat bread. But anyway, so you're going to have your sandwich made. And they make your sandwich, and you're going to go out on your walk, and you stop to eat. And it's not cucumbers, vegan cream cheese, and a red onion. It's peanut butter and jelly. And what happens? What do you think happens? Are you pleased? No, you're not pleased at all. This is not the way I wanted it. There's nothing wrong with peanut butter and jelly. It's a perfectly fine sandwich. They taste good, but it's not what you wanted. That's a really, really simple example. But that's how we respond in life to so many things. That's not what I want. That isn't the way it's supposed to be. Never considering somebody did what they thought was best for you, that they thought that you would like it. So how do we start doing this? How do we start letting it be? Well, what we're doing here today is a start. Having a meditation practice is so, so, so important. It can never be stressed enough. And an aside, the Buddha talked about 40 types of meditation practices that are in the Pali Canon. There's probably more. And here's an aside. I actually talked to Ayasantachita and Ayananda Bodhi about this. I did a talk on the Buddhist personality types a few years ago. And I asked them, do you ever use this when you're going to interview somebody or come up with a meditation practice? And they both said yes. It's based on greed, hatred, and delusion. For many of us, we need to practice one way. Somebody else might need to practice a different way. I'll tell you what works for me, and then you have to figure out what works for you. And you talk to teachers like Aya about this kind of thing, and they can give you some direction. Here's another aside. When I was in community Dharma training, Joseph Goldstein came one time as our teacher for that particular retreat. And he talked about Buddhist personality types, which I had never heard of before, but found out they're for real. And he said, if you want to know what kind of personality type you are, imagine yourself going to a party, and you walk into the party. There's all kinds of people there, and it's a house you've never been at, and there's music playing, and you're by yourself, and you walk in. How do you respond? He said, the greedy type will go in and look around going, God, I love those furnishings. I wish I had that. That music is fantastic. I gotta buy that. I gotta buy that. I gotta go on iTunes and get that as soon as I can. Oh, this is great. I want my house to look like this. I want a party like this. The aversive type would be going and finding fault with everything. Oh, can you believe that color scheme? Oh, that music. Who picked out that music? Look what she's wearing. Oh, my God. And then the doubtful type would not be noticing anything. They would just be concerned about themselves and how they are viewed. I didn't like that exercise. I didn't like what I found out about it. It was a little bit painful, but something that you can look at. The Buddha actually said there's only three meditation techniques that he recommend for everybody. Anybody want to take a guess what they are?
Anapanasati.
That's right. Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing.
Walking.
No, but that's good. I mean, everybody did walk, and that's probably a fourth one now that you're bringing it up. What would be a second one? You all know it.
Metta.
That's right. That's right, metta. Boundless friendliness, loving kindness is the second. The third is not as well known, and I doubt if many of you know it. I consider it one of the most important. It's Maranasati. Mara in Buddhist or Pali language means death. Sati is mindfulness of. Maranasati is mindfulness of death. And the Buddha actually suggested in the Maranasati Sutta that you should be mindful of death with every breath. That's kind of a little difficult to do, but I think you get the point. Aya and I were talking about it at lunchtime, and she said she brought with her the five recollections, which I know is part of my practice. And looking out, I know it's for many people who are at SIM, it's part of your practice too. And it's the practice of reminding ourselves how impermanent our lives are and how impermanent everything else is. It's not a morose thing. In fact, it just makes you more grateful for what you've got. If you were actively dying now, you would not be keeping the same resentments, hatred. You would not put off what needs to be done. You would do what you want to do. You would be enjoying life. You would want... Matt took my A Year to Live class, which I taught for 3 years. And for me, it was one of the most beneficial teachings I gained from myself. I enjoyed it tremendously. And it's the basis of my practice today. So the five... daily recollections is, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to experience ill health. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, supported and abided by my karma. All that my karma is, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So that's just the way it is. That's the Dharma. This is the Dharma in a nutshell. You're repeating the truth about how life is. You begin to see that everything is interconnected. Everything is interconnected. Part of the problem with the ego, and part of the reason we have so many problems in letting it be, is because we think we are some separate entity dealing with all of this all by ourselves, when actually we are connected with everything. And through meditation, you start seeing that. And quit taking yourself so seriously. As Miguel Ruiz said at the beginning, there's a huge amount of freedom that comes to you when you take nothing personally. Can you imagine that kind of freedom where you just don't take it personally? Like my friend with her husband, she didn't take it personally. She saw through all the layers of ego into actually what was taking place. She saw the truth of that situation. And because of her own patience, she was able to offer that teaching to her husband as well. Ajahn Chah said, let go a little, there's a little freedom. Let go a little more, there's more freedom. Let go completely, there's a lot of freedom, complete freedom. Aya and I were talking about this at lunchtime, and often, freedom is not exactly what we think it is, especially if you've gone on retreat and you have lost that sense of ego, of self-identity. It can actually be pretty scary. There's no place to land. But that's life. This is accepting really how life is. there is no place to land. There isn't. And to be able to accept that and be comfortable with it and to let it be, that's freedom. I'm going to finish up with a poem that I just heard on Science Friday yesterday. And if any of you listened to Science Friday yesterday, you might have heard it. It's by Marie Howe. Did you happen to hear it yesterday? I thought Rich, being a scientist, I love Science Friday. I rarely miss it. I just find it so fascinating, the things they come up with. It's on NPR, and it's from in Sacramento, 11 to 1. Yeah. And they go into climate change and hopeful things and new discoveries, and it's really wonderful. Amy watches it, or I'm sorry, listens to it. Anyway, the one yesterday, they have a book club, and this month's book club was dedicated to Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. Were you like me and tried to read it about 1,000 times? I did too. And I love leaving it out like I really was reading it, but I never did get very far with it. But I love the idea that somebody had a mind that could do this, even if mine couldn't. So the book club was reading A Brief History of Time. They were discussing it. And this woman, Marie Howe, is a scientist herself. And so she wrote this poem dedicated to Stephen Hawking. And as I and I were talking at lunch, I really don't collect poetry that much, but this one spoke to me so deeply that I had to go look it up and have it. So here it is. It's called Singularity, which is, if you know about Stephen Hawking, singularities and black holes, you know, were his love. It's what he loved studying and the physics that no longer apply that we now study don't apply when it comes to singularities and black holes. Okay, so it's, do you sometimes want to wake up to the singularity we once were? So compact, nobody needed a bed or food or money. Nobody hiding in the school bathroom or home alone, pulling open the drawer where the pills are kept. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. Do you remember? There was no nature, there was no them. No test to determine if the elephant grieves for her fallen calf. If the coral reef feels pain, trashed oceans don't speak English or Farsi or French. Would that we could wake up to what we were when we were the ocean and before that. To when sky was earth and animal was energy and rock was liquid and stars are space and space was not at all, nothing. Before we came to believe humans were so important, before this awful loneliness, can molecules recall it? What once was, before anything happened? No I, no we, no one, no was, no verb, no noun. Only a tiny, tiny dot brimming with is. Everything is home. So that is the end of my Dharma talk. We're going to do a... does anybody have any comments or anything they wish to offer? Or questions? We are going to have a Q&A session a little later on.